Welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. If we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Music. Well, what does it do for the brain scientifically? Who better to ask than doctor by day, musician by night, Dr. Neil Barnard. In his day job, he researches the effects of music on the brain. He's a physician and researcher on the faculty of the George Washington University and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He'll join us in the first half to talk about his research.
And then switching gears to the U.S. nuclear arsenal, a timely and important topic. Was the atom bomb's first detonation, as President Harry Truman said, the greatest thing in history? Or was it, as one of the scientists who first imagined it remarked, one of history's greatest blunders? Our guest, Dan Zak, a reporter of the Washington Post, explores the duality of these questions by weaving them into the story of the 2012 break-in of a nuclear stronghold in Tennessee by three peace activists.
Really timely topic. Looking forward to that conversation. These guests, when we return, it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Carolyn, Executive Director at Recycle Utah. I would like to invite you to celebrate local food and farms at our second annual 100 Mile Meal on August 12th. This beautiful evening includes live music, drinks, a five-course dinner featuring ingredients sourced within a 100-mile radius of the Recycling Center. Tickets are available at recycleutah.org. Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for over 25 years, and we support KPCW.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Well, you know, John, there's so much we can tell now about the chemistry of our brain by the amount of brain scans and the quality of brain scans, functional MRIs that we can do now. Music, as it turns out, stimulates the reward centers in our brain, and that is the basis of the research done by our first guest, Dr. Neil Barnard. He is a doctor by day, a musician by night. He joins us now to talk about his research. Good morning to you, Dr. Barnard.
Good morning. Great to be with you today.
Great to have you with us. So where did this interest, or where was the genesis of your research? You're a doctor, you're a musician, and all along your whole life, probably, you've known about the reward center of your brain when it comes to music.
Well, I never really put these two things together. I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, and my parents had the idea that any civilized person ought to be able to play at least two instruments. So I was sort of chained to the piano and cello throughout my upbringing. But I never really thought of that as having any medical application. And when I was in medical school and residency, I did have bands. I live in the Washington, D.C. area now, and so I was very active in the music scene. But where this all came together was I was doing a research study for the National Institutes of Health on diabetes. And we started to notice that there were some patients who had cravings for food. And in a minute, I'll explain how music comes into this. We would use completely vegan diets to help their diabetes. They would do great. They would lose weight and everything. But they would crave certain foods. They would crave cheese or junk food. And I thought, what's that about? So we did some special testing, and we found that they had too low levels of dopamine in their brain. Specifically, they didn't have as many receptors in their brain for this pleasure chemical, which is dopamine. And so they would, without their knowing it, they would seek out junk food, or in some cases worse than that, maybe drinks, you know, drugs or whatever, to get the dopamine that their brain was desiring. And this was harming our research, because these are people, we're trying to keep them on a healthy diet, we want to see what that'll do, but they were seeking out junk food to get their dopamine hits. Okay. As we were doing that research, some other researchers were doing brain scans on dopamine receptors, and what they found was that you could use certain things other than junk food to stimulate those very same dopamine receptors. And one was socialization. So if you're with other people, the more intimate the encounter, the more dopamine you'd get. The second one was physical activity. So if you exercise, you got dopamine. However, there was another one, and that was music. And music, in other words, tricks this very same part of the brain that is looking for dopamine into kind of shutting down and stopping and saying, okay, great, I got all the dopamine I need. I don't need any drugs. I don't need any junk food. I'm happy. So the beauty of that is Beethoven doesn't have any cholesterol. And so instead of the patient searching for junk food to get their dopamine hit, you can use music in its place. And from there, music has all kinds of specific medicinal effects that you can actually use clinically.
So specific medicinal effects. So this would suggest that it's the type of music. I know that you've said it can't be just any old music that doesn't create some emotional response in the listener.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You would think, okay, it's got to be happy music. It's got to be jolly music because dopamine is my pleasure center. And that turned out not to be the case. You can put the research participant in your brain scanner and you're watching the dopamine centers light up. And sad music can stimulate it as well. However, what they have in common is it's always experienced as pleasurable. So let's say it's Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, and it's very, I mean, no one would call it a happy toe-tapping tune, right, but they would describe it as very, very beautiful, even if it's sad. However, so it can be happy or it can be sad, but if you play bluegrass for a person who hates bluegrass, or you play hip-hop for a person who, that's not their thing.
No dopamine release.
The dopamine stays totally quiet. In fact, you got to be careful about that, because there's sometimes when you've selected the Beatles' greatest hits played by the Holly Ridge Strings, and it turns out the patient had a root canal where they were listening to that exact same music in the dentist's office, and they hate that music. So, you know, you can't use that medicinally.
I was watching a special on HBO recently, and Dr. Dre was recording a hip-hop band, and he was just so jazzed. I mean, you could tell that he was just really enjoying this cut that was being recorded. So possibly for Dr. Dre, for that particular piece of music that was hip-hop, could that possibly have lit up his pleasure centers versus not so much for someone else?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. And you can also, one of the interesting applications of this is for Alzheimer's patients. You can take a person where they have had Alzheimer's. Let's say they've had it for 4, 5, 6 years. And it starts out, they can't remember a word, they can't remember a name, then they can't remember their children's names, they can't remember their spouse's name, and you lose track of, you lose your connection with them. That same person, you can either sing to them or say to them lyrics of a song that they knew when they were 8 or 10 years old. And they will start singing along with it. They will get the lyrics right. If you make a mistake in the melody, they will correct you. So we started to see that the part of the brain that is involved in music recognition it's really preserved when the rest of the brain is being destroyed. However, you can then use this to calm them down. If the patient is agitated, you can use the same thing. But if you select music that they were not familiar with, it doesn't have that effect. It's got to be something that kind of imprinted earlier. So for Dr. Dre, if you play for him Glenn Campbell, you know, he's not going to go for it. But if on the other hand, you play for him the things that were familiar to him as a young man, when he is old, he will respond to them in a positive way.
Music is a language into itself. I mean, people that are chronic stutterers, when they sing, they don't stutter. And they're able to structure a completely different type of communicating and being able to understand a communication. It's fascinating.
It really is remarkable. And back on the Alzheimer's for just a second, there are a lot of folks with Alzheimer's who are medicated, just to calm them down. They get agitated, particularly if they are in physical pain that they can't tell you about, or if they are confused about what's happening. And so in addition to sorting out why they might be in pain, if you know which time of day they tend to get agitated, you use 30 minutes of music. You ask the family, what did they listen to when they were young? You play that music for about 30 minutes. They're calm during and after the music selection. And then, so that's sort of a calming effect. You can use the same thing with a person who's 20 years old, and they're in the hospital. They're going to have a knee surgery for a football injury. You can give them a sedative. As they're going into surgery, they'll calm down. If instead of a medication, you give them music that they pre-selected, you will discover they don't request the sedative. Their anxiety level is dramatically less. And then they come out of surgery, and they're in pain, and they're asking for pain medicines. And you don't tell them you're doing this, but you just ask them to listen to medicine, but surreptitiously you're tracking their medication use. They use substantially less medication if they've got music. If they don't have it, for whatever reason, their pain is higher and they request more medication.
This is interesting, and it's bringing up some questions for me about the happy chemicals. So we've got dopamine, we've got serotonin, there's endorphin, and,
right.
and maybe you could just talk a little bit about those, because when you talk about dopamine release and, you know, something that makes us happy, yet it's also something that will help us if we otherwise would be taking a sedative to calm down. Talk about those effects.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. And we had thought, and many people still think, why do I eat food? I like the taste. Why am I calling up some friends and arranging a party? Because they're my friends. I like them. Why am I having a drink? Well, it calms me down. What people are missing is that the brain is responding to all these things, and the brain, even without your understanding it, is making selections to get certain neurotransmitters to different levels than they would be otherwise. So you mentioned dopamine, which is the purpose of dopamine, if I can use those words. It's supposed to reward you for finding a food source or a receptive mate. So That's what nature had in mind. And so you can imagine that if you have a certain amount of food, you get a little dopamine, but if you pick junk food, that puts it into hyperdrive, a receptive mate, fine, so socialization. But we tend to exaggerate the things that elicit dopamine release. Serotonin can be affected by food. It causes, it improves your mood. It's also involved in sleep. So many of the things that we do from day to day are really determined by these neurotransmitters, and we're manipulating them all day long without recognizing that that's what we're doing.
It's so funny. So the purpose, as you say, if you can call it that, of dopamine is the reward for finding your next bite of food or your next mate. And it really makes sense when you think about music. I mean, we've all got those songs that when we play, it reminds us of our first heartbreak or the first time we fell in love. And you can just elicit that response inside you, this physiological response, having to do with finding a mate or losing a mate. I like that.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, I write music, and our band is called Carbon Works, as in we are made of carbon, and these are our works. And they're wonderful musicians, I have to say. If you're a fan of George Clooney movies, George Clooney was in a movie called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And he broke out of prison, and he encounters a guitarist standing at the crossroads named, this guitarist is named Chris Thomas King, and he's the greatest blues guitarist in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And he's on our record. You'll hear him on Carbon Works record. We have a whole bunch of there's 16 of us who are involved in this project. When we write, I write the songs, I arrange everything. But when we're doing it, it's never really intellectual, like let's have something in 3-4 times. It always has to touch that emotional side. So if there is no element of love or excitement or something like that, it's just sterile and it's dead. So you think, well, that's because that's the only kind of music I like. Fair enough. Your brain is actually guiding you to say, this is the language that you must speak if it's going to be perceived as enjoyable by anybody else. So songs are always about something like that.
Mm. I'm not a musician, so I don't even know I don't have the right words to frame this question, but I'm wondering if you design and write music so that it does elicit different responses. And if so, is it tempo? Is it the beat? What are the elements that might elicit different types of or different amounts of dopamine release?
Yeah, great question. The real key thing, I believe, with almost all kinds of music, no matter what genre it is you need to hit a balance between predictability and unpredictability. So if you think about a rhyme, you're going to have the second line is going to rhyme with the first, but you know that's going to happen, but you're never quite sure what it's going to be. And you hear the song, the chorus becomes familiar, but it's got to have a little bit of unpredictability that keeps it interesting. So good composers are always going back and forth between making sure it's repetitive enough that I don't lose you and it's not chaotic, but not so much that there aren't little twists and turns around every corner. And then if you want to ramp up the excitement of it, the tempo can be faster, it can be louder, it can be you can include a lot more unpredictable elements. Then if you want to be calmer, you slow it down. I often pick different kinds of vocal qualities depending on the emotional response that we're trying to get.
Dr. Zach,
you can also use different languages. I have to tell you, this is a funny thing. I wrote a song in English, and it was a very emotional song, but I heard on the radio an Italian singer who absolutely knocked me out. Her name is Naif, N-A-I-F. And I called her up, and I said, I want you here in the United States. And she flew over, and she sang this song, not in English, but in Italian. And we call it Song for an Angel, and she has the most angelic voice. And I left it in Italian on the record because there is something about not quite understanding these words and it being in this tremendously romantic language that is just firing up your dopamine. So there you are.
Dr. Barnard, I'm curious. Some people may feel that, I got duped 25 years ago when people were talking about Beethoven being played when your wife is pregnant and the child will come out more gifted. And that was a lot of rhetoric, actually. But is all of this peer-reviewed studies, double-blind studies, those sorts of things?
I am so glad that you asked that, because there is more nonsense in the world of science and medicine than just about anywhere else, because everyone's got something they're trying to sell. And that, in the work that we do, yes, everything that we do has to be peer-reviewed, and the journal articles that we're looking at has to be carefully looked at. That doesn't mean people can't fool you. So you have to sometimes replicate things for yourself. But the studies, when I was describing earlier, the studies looking at dopamine release from different kinds of music, I think the best work on this comes out of McGill University, where they've done scanning studies over and over and over again, and not just on music, but on alcohol and drugs and many different things, and pretty soon you do get confidence in them. But there is a lot of nonsense out there, like a woman who, just as you said, if a woman is listening to a certain kind of music, the child will come out in a certain way. It's good for her to listen to that music, but it's really good for her, not the baby. It's going to calm her down and make her feel better and make the labor less traumatic for her, but it's not going to make the child a better musician.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Dr. Neil Barnard, who is a musician by night. In his day job, he researches the effects of music on the brain. Boy, I was thinking about something this morning before we got in here, and several days ago I went to a symphony concert that was a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's being released from the Beatles, and I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and he and I were both music nuts, and we're talking about exactly where we were in 1967 when the album came out, and talking about individual cuts of the album and, what we thought about it back then, what we think about it now. And another friend of mine who is indifferent to music, when I say indifferent, he doesn't listen to it, he doesn't go to concerts, he doesn't talk about it. I mean, he thought we were nuts. Now, he's indifferent to music, but what he really likes is money, and he watches the stock market all the time, and that really, he gets so excited when he sees the little clicks going up and he's making money. Would it be a stretch to say that things that people find that make them happy, that their reward centers would light up in certain ways versus people that were indifferent to those things?
Yes, I think that's a great observation. And the flip side of the coin is there are certain things that can make you anxious and nervous, and those can interfere with it. So, for example, I don't mean to psychoanalyze your friend, but let's say
it's impossible.
Let's say you're a person who is, for whatever reason, coming from a background of instability and insecurity, and you're not sure where your next dollar is going to come from. There are plenty of people back who grew up during the Great Depression who dedicated the whole rest of their life to financial security, even when they were perfectly secure. And so if they're not thinking about money, they feel nervous. You want me to listen to music? Heck with that. I want to make sure that my stocks are going up. Then, of course, the next generation, their kids, had plenty of money. So they're not concerned about that. They don't get anxious worrying about whether they're going to have money or not. And they start a rock and roll band. And so they're interested in that side of things. You see what I mean?
I do.
It's certain things give you pleasure. Other things give you anxiety. And those things, when you are nervous, that is not a time when you're able to necessarily free up the emotional wherewithal to enjoy certain things.
So let's just try taking it one more step. There's a tremendous research out there about brain research, about brain scans, those sorts of things. And recently I had read that that when people have alcohol introduced to them and they're being monitored, their brain scans, that people who are alcoholics, their brains light up like Christmas trees as far as the pleasure centers and all that. And the people that not so much, you know, they may have some pleasure centers lighting up, but not to the extent that the alcoholic has. They say that
right.
There's a correlation between the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic and their genetic makeup. Are all of these things that give us pleasure, is there a link to our genetic makeup, or is this just things that we have found to be pleasurable?
I briefly mentioned this earlier. I think you're putting your finger on a really critically important thing that has terrible ramifications. I mentioned earlier we were doing diabetes research, and I genotyped all of our participants, and I found that in about 50% of people with type 2 diabetes, they have whatever genes they may have that increase the risk of diabetes, they also have a gene for too little dopamine activity. Specifically, they have about one-third fewer dopamine receptors in their brain. So here's what this means. I might be predisposed to diabetes. However, if I don't have enough dopamine activity naturally, because I don't have the dopamine receptors in my brain that other people have, and somewhere along the line I discover that if I take a drink, if I smoke, or if I overeat chocolate and junk food, I get more dopamine, then that overeating then makes me gain weight. And as I gain weight, then suddenly I'm not just feeding the dopamine, but now my diabetes genes start to kick in. So I could be at risk for diabetes, but it's that dopamine deficit, which is also genetic, that then causes the weight gain and then causes the diabetes to manifest. So that kind of person gets much more pleasure from drugs, from alcohol, from anything that elicits dopamine, compared with the person who already has an adequate number of dopamine receptors naturally. That person says, "Why? What's the big deal about drinking?" Because they get dopamine normally.
Wow, that's fascinating. And we know that type 2 diabetes is the preventable, quote-unquote, type of diabetes versus type 1. And so I would be interested in seeing the difference between those with type 1 and their genotype and those with type 2. Because really, doesn't that, you know, it's 50% genotype with the type 2 and then 50%, bringing on or brought on through poor habits?
Yes. Well, in both cases, it's poor dietary habits. But the ones where they have a gene that has too little dopamine, they are really driven to eat more because of the lack of dopamine. And then when they're eating more, then the diabetes comes up. By the way, interestingly enough, we're also finding that type 1 may be preventable too in certain ways because what we think they are just earlier childhood exposures. The big issue now is cow's milk. Kids should be breastfed by their mother, and cow's milk can trigger the release of antibodies in the child's bloodstream that may be what killed off their insulin-producing cells. That's a theory. Wow. There's a lot of evidence for it, but stay tuned. Bottom line, kids should be breastfed by mom, and they actually don't need milk from a cow.
We're getting off on a tangent here with diabetes, but it's fascinating. And I have a nephew who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, but it was after he got Giardia. And there's some correlation there,
infections
perhaps.
Do the same thing, yes. Mm. They trigger this it's an immune reaction to some foreign protein, whether it's the cow's milk protein or an infection. And then, in turn, those antibodies destroy the insulin-producing cells. It's like friendly fire.
Wow.
Boy. What one question have you not been able to answer that you'd like to have answered?
There are so many of them. The big question I would have is, how can we get rid of all these things that are shanghaiing our dopamine receptors that we wish we didn't have? Every single drug of abuse that has been developed, when people figured out how to turn poppies into opium and so forth, all of these things trigger dopamine. Alcohol, tobacco, energy drinks, everything. And so the question I have is, once society has wandered into them, how do we get rid of them? And because we're now paying a price for this that has no end in sight. So we are continuing to study applications, finding people to resist them. But if I could wave a magic wand and just get rid of some of these toxins, I sure would do it.
And Dr. Bernard, through socialization, through exercise, through listening to pleasurable music, does that over time increase our receptors so that we would be able to produce even more dopamine?
No, it doesn't. The receptors you've got are the receptors that you got. And when you stimulate them, you do get that bit of dopamine. And unfortunately, if it was something really unhealthy, crack cocaine, for example, it stimulates them to such an extent that you find yourself wanting that same stimulation again.
Mm.
Way back when our forebears, they liked an apple or a plum, and then somebody figured out chocolate and cheese and other things that are just so seductive that we no longer care about the healthy things that our brains were designed to appreciate.
Wow. What an interesting conversation, Dr. Neil Bernard. And before we let you go, I just have to ask you, because we were having a conversation on yesterday's show about Alzheimer's disease, and then Glenn Campbell, who you've mentioned during this interview,
yes,
having passed away just 2 days ago. And it just makes me wonder about his connection to music and the reward center of his brain. It didn't seem to halt the onset of Alzheimer's, and in fact, he passed away quite quickly in relative terms.
He did. When he had the Alzheimer's, interestingly enough, although he would have terrible trouble remembering words and so forth, he could still stand on stage and sing.
Mm.
And the tunes and everything were great, and he was good with the lyrics up to a point. If they got too complex, he would start to lose those too. But the musical parts were preserved. Stay tuned. There is a lot of research now on how to prevent Alzheimer's, and this is a whole other thing we could talk about at some point. But in Chicago, researchers have looked for nutritional traits of the people who develop Alzheimer's disease, finding that there are indeed patterns. And so my goal now is, I don't want just for people to be able to manipulate their brain chemistry with music, but depending on what you put on your plate, we can also help prevent some of these disasters. At least we believe we can do that to a degree.
Wow. Okay, we'll have you back on. Would you like to join us again on Cool Science Radio?
Please include me anytime. We've got lots of important things to say, and I appreciate your allowing us to share this time.
All right. Thank you. And it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We're going from dopamine and the reward centers of our brains being stimulated by music into the U.S. nuclear arsenal when we return.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
This is Beth, owner of Peak Art and Frame, local sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame offers local artwork as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
In July 2012, a trio of anti-nuclear peace activists snuck into and vandalized the Y-12 National Security Complex in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is a repository of hundreds of tons of highly enriched uranium and supposedly one of the most secure buildings in the world. Well, not so much. With the break-in and their symbolic actions, the activists hope to draw attention to a costly military-industrial complex that stockpiles deadly nukes. Our guest, Washington Post reporter and author Dan Zak, explores the story, which he researched over 4 years, as well as the troubling concept of why the United States and other countries possess enough nuclear weaponry to destroy our world a number of times over. Zak's new book, Almighty: Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. He joins us by phone. Zak, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, this is a timely and important topic, isn't it?
Apparently so, yeah.
Yeah, Lynn and I had Eric Schlosser on a couple years ago for Command and Control, and, well, you know, we had nightmares after that program, and I'm sure we'll have them after we talk with you as well. Maybe you can take us a bit back to this trio and how they got into such a secure building.
Sure. I'm glad you mentioned Eric's book, too, Command and Control, which was about a nuclear accident in Arkansas in 1980. My book is about, it's also an incident, but it was committed intentionally by three peace activists just over 5 years ago in East Tennessee, in a city called Oak Ridge, 30 minutes outside of Knoxville. These three peace activists, one of whom was a then 82-year-old Catholic nun, in the middle of the night hiked a wooded ridge, cut through four fences, three of which were alarmed, and essentially waltzed right up to this storage facility that houses all of our highly enriched uranium that's not somewhere in a warhead around the planet. It's thought to be this building, the largest stockpile of fissile material on the planet. So some people might say it's the most dangerous building on the planet, and yet three senior citizens who were armed with nothing but bolt cutters and spray paint got pretty far in, got up to this building, spray painted biblical messages of peace, sprinkled human blood on it, and then essentially waited to be arrested.
So it's not so much the political ramifications, but it's that what if terrorists had been able to get into that building? What could they have done?
Well, that's kind of how the official response from the U.S. government was, or from Congress, is it's a good thing, you know, Congress was saying in hearings afterward, it's a good thing that these were peace activists and not terrorists. I mean, it depends on whom you talk to about what could have happened if the people who had broke in and had this uninterrupted time near this facility, what they could have done. I talked to someone from the Project on Government Oversight who said, you know, if terrorists had had 20 minutes or so, which is what these peace activists had, of uninterrupted access, they could have brought in, a conventional explosive that could have penetrated the exterior of this building and done something nasty with the highly enriched uranium in there. Now, I mean, the chances of that happening are pretty slim. The walls of this storage facility are reinforced concrete. They're designed to withstand the impact of a commercial jet. And so plenty of people involved at this site and in the government said there's no way, even if someone with ill intent had gotten as far as these activists, could have gotten into this building. The chances are so vanishingly small. Of course, my reaction to that is, well, where would you have put the odds on an 82-year-old woman in the middle of the night getting as far as she did? So I think it's the what-ifs are worth thinking about, and that's what this incident brought up, and that's what I explore in my book.
How calculated was this break-in? Did they actually know, or did they surprise even themselves that they gained entry?
You know, I think they were surprised at how easy and how far they got. I mean, these activists acted in a long tradition of kind of progressive radical Catholicism going back to 1980, when the Berrigan brothers, the priests, the famous radical priests, and others first broke into a nuclear weapons facility in Pennsylvania. This was 1980. And the aim was to kind of make the words of the book of Isaiah concrete. You know, they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. And so the Berrigan brothers and others thought, well, let's kind of make those words a reality and actually break into these facilities, hammer on the nose cones of missiles, spray paint buildings, sprinkle human blood, and remind people what these facilities are meant to do and the weapons that these facilities manufacture and maintain. So, you know, these actions, these break-ins have been oddly successful over the years. And these three particular activists that I write about in Tennessee, you know, they were surprised, but they weren't surprised because they believe they had rightness on their side, God on their side, and they think the ease with which they got in was by the grace of God. Of course, you know, when I looked into it, the reasons they got so far were a bit more pedestrian. This facility in Tennessee was used to 2,000-plus false alarms every day, false alarms caused by the breeze, by foliage, by wildlife. And the camera that was trained on the area of the fence that they cut through had been out of commission for 6 months. So there was a problem with security already at this facility.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about security. As you went about researching for this book, you know, the incidence of breaches of security and leaking of contaminated material, were you surprised? Were you shocked? What did it do for you in terms of your relationship to our nuclear arsenal?
Well, I guess, I mean, it was a shocking event, but when you look at it in the context of our now 72 years of being a nuclear power, it's also, you know, scarily in line with past incidents and close calls. I mean, ever since we developed and tested the first nuclear weapon in 1945, our nuclear weapons enterprise has been kind of plagued by near catastrophes. I mean, Eric Schlosser, wrote about in his book an incident in the early 1960s over North Carolina. A bomber broke up and dropped a couple thermonuclear warheads in someone's backyard in North Carolina. And the fusing mechanisms all were charged except for one that short-circuited, that wasn't working. And if that had worked, there would have been an explosion in North Carolina many, many times that of Hiroshima. We've had radar systems both in the U.S. and in the Soviet Union and Russia that have misinterpreted sunlight reflecting off clouds or research rockets as incoming nuclear missiles. And both countries have gotten very close to ordering a nuclear response to a threat that didn't even exist. So, you know, we've been plagued by these kinds of problems for years. So you could sort this incident in 2012 that I write about as part of this kind of long tradition of close calls. But still, there are people who think that this break-in in 2012 in East Tennessee is, you know, the most serious breach of physical nuclear security domestically ever.
Let's talk specifically about the two incidents that you brought up. And I read in one of your articles in 1979, Carter's national security advisor, Brzezinski, was told that hundreds of missiles were on their way from the Soviet Union. And a minute before he called the president to, you know, coordinate something that could be just devastating, he was told that the military had misinterpreted a training exercise. The Russians did the same thing in 83 and 95. Are we asking for trouble? I mean, we have this technology, but these misinterpretations, they could happen again, couldn't they?
They could, yeah. And I think as long as nuclear weapons exist, we are gambling. We believe, I say we, you know, the U.S. government, other nuclear armed powers, we believe that they are the foundation of our national security, that by having an arsenal, we can deter any kind of major attack, and that these weapons, given how terrible they are if used, kind of make the prospect of major war so abhorrent that no one would ever use them. But of course, you know, we are gambling. We're kind of weighing that against the possibility of miscalculation or accident. Those incidents that I mentioned and that you mentioned are evidence that, you know, we've gotten pretty close, and how much longer can we be as lucky to avoid that, especially now that tensions are kind of heightened with North Korea. You know, if tensions are heightened, I think the probability of some kind of misunderstanding or overreaction is heightened. And what does that mean when you're trying to make decisions very quickly about the fate of the Earth?
We're talking with Dan Zak, who's written, he's a Washington Post reporter, but he's also written Almighty Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. Dan, let's talk a little bit about, everyone's curious about this. Can you describe the briefcase that accompanies the president wherever he goes? And can you also talk about the biscuit?
Sure. So they're called the biscuit and the football. The football is the 45-pound leather-clad briefcase that is always carried by a military aide by the president. So when President Trump is, you know, traveling to Mar-a-Lago, the briefcase is going with him. When the president is doing business in Washington, the briefcase is with him. When he's golfing, the briefcase is with him. And in this briefcase is essentially a menu of options for nuclear strikes, kind of a takeout menu, where you can order this option to strike here, this option to strike there. And the biscuit is something that the president always keeps with him. It's a small plastic card with the codes that would authorize a nuclear strike. There's only one person that can authorize a strike, and that is the president. And he authenticates that order with the codes on this plastic card. So I think it's kind of a reminder just about what is the foundational authority we're investing in the U.S. president. Well, it's represented by the biscuit and by the football. They're always with him, and they're always at the ready should he need to make a decision involving nuclear weapons.
In a way, it's humorous. I mean, you also mentioned that Jimmy Carter is rumored to have sent the biscuit to the dry cleaners accidentally, and Bill Clinton, he lost the biscuit for months.
Yeah, it's this kind of falls in line with you know, how much we're gambling on this system. I mean, human beings are imperfect, and we create imperfect systems. You know, when Reagan was shot in the hospital when his suit was cut off as he went into surgery, you know, the FBI scooped up the biscuit as evidence and then didn't return it to the military for weeks. So, you know, there's this kind of long history of mishap. You know, you could argue that the biscuit is the most important object on the planet because it's the thing that the president would use to launch a strike that could kill millions of people. And yet it is a physical object prone to being misplaced or something like that just as much as anything else. And yet it kind of holds the keys to Armageddon.
Right. So we're dealing with, you know, the most powerful and destructive devices ever created. We are talking about our sometimes clumsy handling of them. We're talking about the volatility, perhaps, of our nuclear arsenal. And we're also talking about the fire and fury, what is it, fire and fury rhetoric of,
and power.
Of that person who's holding the football biscuit. What does that do for you, having just spent all these years researching this book?
Well, I mean, it certainly can be a topic that is both alarming and depressing, because, you know, it makes me think, well, what can an individual do about this? You know, you feel kind of helpless, knowing, A, that these weapons exist, and B, that there's so many of them, just under 15,000 nuclear warheads on the planet. And C, that they're in the control of one person. You know, you know, how do you get through your day knowing that? And I think, you know, the way to combat a feeling of helplessness is just to be attentive and to educate yourself. I mean, my process of researching and writing this book was hugely eye-opening, and I felt a sense of shame in how much I didn't know. I mean, I was born, you know, in 1983 into a world obsessed with nuclear weapons, but I came of age in a world post-Cold War, a post-Cold War world where the weapons had kind of receded from everyone's imagination, and now we have multiple generations of Americans who did not grow up in a duck and cover mentality, who did not grow up during the nuclear freeze movement of the Reagan years, and who are more focused on another existential crisis, and that would be climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these weapons might have receded from people's imagination, but they have not gone away. There's still, you know, almost 15,000 on the planet, as I said, and they're now, you know, dozens of times more powerful than Hiroshima. And, you know, as we're seeing with Russia, as we're seeing with North Korea, they still remain at the forefront of both diplomacy and of saber rattling. And really, I think all the individual can do is pay attention and, if necessary, talk to one's congressman about it. Because when it comes down to it, these are just devices that need funding just like anything else the government does, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to make an seemingly intractable, godlike problem a little more manageable.
Wow. Do you think we also operate on, I mean, as soon as you brought up climate change and our focus on that is so strong, and yet our focus on our nuclear arsenal is, I think, maybe governed more by blind trust and just this hope that somewhere out there it's just all going to be okay. And it, you know, it just makes me wonder, what do we know about North Korea's nuclear arsenal? Do we?
Yeah. Well, we don't know as much as we know about other arsenals. Obviously, it's a very secretive, insular regime. You know, the latest estimations by some people is that they have 60 nuclear warheads. There are other experts who think that is an overestimation, that it's around 10 or 20 warheads. But what we do know now, as of you know, last month, these past couple weeks, is they have a missile that could deliver a nuclear warhead to the continental U.S., which is a major advance. And then now, just in the past couple of days, there's a report that they have what they call miniaturized a nuclear warhead, which just means that they can now fit an effective nuclear warhead on that missile. So they are kind of in the final stages of being able to threaten the United States with a nuclear weapon. Now, of course, this sounds like cause for panic, but I think, you know, and it is cause for concern, but what does it really mean? Would North Korea fire a nuclear weapon just out of the blue at us? I would argue no. This is still a nation state, however insular, backward, and authoritarian. There's still a regime that wants to survive. So it really kind of goes to illustrate that these are not just weapons of war. These are political weapons. You know, this kind of impoverished authoritarian nation can kind of sit at the big boys' table and be taken seriously by superpowers because they have achieved a kind of nuclear-armed power here. So it's a reminder that nuclear weapons play multiple roles, and one of them serves, in the case of North Korea, as a way to extort other countries, as a way to ensure the regime's survival.
Well, for North Korea, and I might be wrong here because I don't think we have you know, as much data as we want, but I still think that they need a guidance system, and I don't believe they've tested the capability of the reentry of the warhead. Could it survive the heat and those sorts of things? So they still may have a couple of steps, but the number one question that I have is, you know, everything you said I would agree with, but I'm concerned if your leaders have mental health issues, you know, they could I mean, there's no button, but they could hit the button if they're nuts. So that's what I'm concerned about.
Well, that's the system that we've created, investing Launch Authority, Seoul Launch Authority, in the president. I mean, that was a system that's been in place because of the speed with which we would have to react if there's some kind of major incoming nuclear strike, during the Cold War from the Soviet Union. You can't convene, a committee in Congress. You can't have a public vote or referendum on should we use nuclear weapons. I mean, they would be here within minutes. And so someone's got to be the one to say, I order this. And so that's been our policy since the Cold War. Of course, the current president has made some people question that more intensely. Obviously, Hillary Clinton made an issue of Donald Trump's temperament. You know, if you can bait Donald Trump with a tweet, should he have the nuclear codes? And then Representative Ted Lieu of California and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts introduced legislation that would restrict the president from authorizing a first nuclear strike, that if the president would want to strike first with nuclear weapons, he would have to get the approval of Congress. That bill has only been introduced. I anticipate it will ever get voted on, but
right.
It shows how the other branches of government are kind of reacting to this system.
And I learned a lot from reading your articles and everything that you prepared on this topic. And one of the things I found fascinating was, as you talked about, the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, the first bombs that we used, at the end of World War II on Japan were kind of crude first attempts at fission bombs. I mean, then we developed fusion bombs, and fission and fusion is kind of correlates to nuclear and thermonuclear bombs. And what a thermonuclear bomb does is that it's a two-stage bomb. It uses fission, which is the breaking up of heavy atoms, uranium and plutonium, and using the heat created there to fuse lighter atoms of hydrogen, which create an even bigger reaction. So thermonuclear is, if you want to talk this in a really crude and elementary way, is just a much more powerful atomic bomb. And those are the bombs we have today. They're two stages. There's a fission reaction involving plutonium and uranium that then causes another reaction of fusion, which fuses elements of hydrogen, which creates an even bigger boom. All this happens in an instant, of course, but it means that our weapons are dozens of times more powerful than the ones we used over Japan in World War II.
And in smaller packages.
Smaller packages. They're more efficient. They're more deadly. The missile that we tested just last week, firing an unarmed missile off of California, as a test of our systems. In a wartime scenario, that missile would carry a warhead that's, I think, about 27 times the destructive power of the one we dropped on Hiroshima, which, of course, killed 160,000 people and destroyed a city. So multiply that by 27, and that's the power in one warhead these days.
Dan Zak, reporter for Washington Post, written a great book, Almighty, Courage, Resistance, and Existential Peril in the Nuclear Age. Dan, thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks to you both.
Okay.
Thank you. Wow, that's a great book.
Yeah.
It's one you want to read cover to cover.
That's right.
Wonder what his next project is, given, or his next article for the Washington Post, given what we've learned last couple of weeks.
We'll stay in touch with Dan, see what he's up to.
That's right. I want to thank our underwriters today, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design, and the Habitat for Humanity Restore.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1970.